Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, we'll talk about some news in the world of Houston restaurants, as well as our meal at a new restaurant you may want to try. To do that, I am joined by my co-host this week. He is the owner of Craft Pita, Rafi Nasser. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey, Eric. I'm doing great, and thanks for having me back.
Thanks for doing this. Let us dive right into the news of the week. Topic number one. Sandbrooks Hospitality has revealed their plans to open a third location of their Tex-Mex concept Candente at a new development in the Heights. This is all still at least a year away, but it's basically going to be near the intersection of Shepherd and 20th. So right in the heart of everything else that's going on in the Heights, Basso, Squabble, Hotel Daphne, Heights Waterworks, et cetera, Burger Joint, Taco Stand, et cetera, et cetera. Rafi, I don't know. What do you think of Candente? It's an interesting restaurant. It's the only Tex-Mex restaurant in Houston that's in the Michelin Guide. It has a recommended designation.
I think it rightfully deserves that. As we've talked about before, I worked in Tex-Mex for about 3-4 years at Papacito's, and I know what it takes in the back of house to run a high quality Tex-Mex operation, and it requires investment. Some people think, you know, oh, Tex-Mex is cheap. No, when you're paying premium for skirt steak, outside skirt steak versus inside, you're using the other quality meats that Sandbrooks uses for their other cuts, and you're making everything from scratch, premium, you know, margaritas, and they do everything. I've seen how they
They cook it all over wood too. They cook it all over live fire, and that's its own expense, constantly buying wood to burn.
And having a chef / line cook that knows how to work with the live fire grill. In my eyes, it's not Tex-Mex if it's not cooked over carbone, in my opinion. I think it's the premier Tex-Mex experience in Houston. I think in Houston, you kind of have to break Tex-Mex restaurants into different price points / quality experiences, right? I think Candente is at the top up there with, you know, Papacito's, El Tiempo.
Right. That's kind of the high end. Maybe Good Company Kitchen and Cantina, right? That's kind of the high end. And then there's like a lower cut, you know, Gringos, Los Tios, the one with the giant tortillas in the playground.
Lupe's.
Lupe tortilla. Thank you.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's the next tier, which is, you know, maybe I'm going to throw like a place like Chewy's or something like that in the mix. Right. And then there's the place right below that, which is like a Taqueria Randas kind of place. Right.
Sure.
And I think that's what you're talking about. Tex-Mex. You have to think of those three categories. I think Candente is at the top of the top tier, in my opinion.
I agree. And I was sort of, you know, I shared this article on the Houston Heights Foodies Facebook page, and there got some weird pushback. A couple of people are like, I don't think Candente is very good. I do not understand that. Like, I pushed back hard on those people, because if you don't like Candente, I mean, I guess you could say it's too smoky would be the only possible objection.
If I ever hear something and they say that, but I'm just like, I don't think that this is what Tex-Mex is. It is skirt steak grilled over live fire. That beef fajitas for me are the number one most important thing at a Tex-Mex place. Number two is queso and guac. Number three is
cheese enchilada. Freshly made,
cheese enchilada to you. I have PTSD for making enchiladas. Not my favorite. And then margaritas. You got to include the margaritas.
Margaritas are definitely in the mix.
And by the way, Candente is one of the few places where I will order those chicken enchiladas with the verde sauce are amazing.
Yes. I mean, that's my thing is I've never had a bad meal at Candente. I've had it be sort of better and worse, you know, but still always enjoyable. And, you know, they just opened in Bel Air at the end of last year. That's been a huge hit. All of my Bel Air Meyerland friends are delighted to have Candente in the neighborhood. And I think this is going to kind of be the same reaction in the Heights. I mean, yes, there is plenty of good Tex-Mex in the Heights. You know, you've got Amalatina, you've got Kitchen and Cantina, you've got Teotihuacan if you go a little farther east. And if you cross Washington, you've got, you know, Cyclone Anaya's certainly, El Tiempo on Washington. There's no shortage in the sort of the extended Heights area. But I'm not surprised to see Michael Sandberg's growing Candente. I'm sure that based on the success that he's had with the Pit Room and Memorial, that he would have loved to be somewhere nearby in the Memorial area. But if the Heights is the opportunity,
that was maybe an option. But
well, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it still happens, right? Like I'm sure on some level he would have
appreciated. For myself, I hope it does.
Well, what an incredible opportunity it would have been if they could have done the Pit Room at one end of the shopping center and Candente at the other end. That's now Katz's. That would have been incredible. But, you know, for whatever, like, I'm not privy to those negotiations. I don't know if that was ever a possibility. I'm just thinking that would have been super fun. But I think Heights residents are going to be super into this. And you know, judging by the readership on the article, there's a lot of excitement about it.
I had this argument with my buddies the other day about what's the best place. I think what I learned in my experience working in Tex-Mex is, one, Tex-Mex is our comfort food. Why is it comfort food? Why are fajitas in particular comfort food? Because everybody can make it their way. It's the center of the table. I like my taco with flour instead of corn, or just guac and onions, or the butter, whatever. I think everyone has to remember it's all about what you like and what you're used to going to, whether you grew up going there or it's your neighborhood place or it's the place that you currently go with your friends. I think that it's like, what is your favorite Tex-Mex at this moment in your life? I think that's what happens. And then the other thing, I think we need to quit talking this conversation of what is a good value fajitas. Fajitas are not a good value nowhere in town. It doesn't matter if it's just two tacos al carbon. You will not get a good deal. Why? Because skirt steak is expensive. It is not cheap. So I'm tired of seeing on all these Facebook food groups and these people, oh, that place is too expensive. Fajitas are expensive, guys. Wake up.
Well, I mean, fajitas are expensive. They're all expensive. I got a little sticker shock several months back. We went to Papacito's. Fajitas for two was $70. And that has become kind of the norm at the higher end places. That's become kind of the going rate. $35. $70.
Very normal.
So that means that your fajitas for two with a couple of margaritas and a queso is a $100 dinner. And I'm old, but it wasn't always that way. You know, that used to be a $50 or $60 dinner. And so I think we all have those memories of when it was less expensive, and we're still adjusting to the way things are now. But I don't think I don't think they're being greedy. I think it's just the ingredients are more expensive and labor's more expensive and everything else is more expensive. And so they charge what the market will bear. And by the way, like, you know, none of these restaurants lack for customers. So, you know, you charge what people are willing to pay. And if people are willing to pay $70 for fajitas for two, then that's what you're going to charge. You know, you just got to kind of keep an eye on, like, at Candente, it's Tuesday where you can get the large fajitas for the medium price. On Wednesdays at Papacito's, it's half price fajitas day. You got to, you know, if you want to moderate your budget a little bit, you got to be a little savvy. You got to keep an eye on the deals.
I think what separates Candente at the end of the day from the rest of the competition is small things like the nachos with the brisket from the Pit Room. All the salsas are excellent. I know that Sandbrooks himself personally goes to Mexico to do these research trips, and he really cares about everything that's on that menu. He's one of the best operators in the city, and I'm looking forward to it being lights. I think it's going to be a huge success. Is there too much Tex-Mex? It's kind of one of those things. There's never too much Tex-Mex. We talked about this when Superica closed. I think they'll steal all those customers from them.
Well, and I think there's never too much good Tex-Mex.
Yes.
Right. And I think kind of after Super Rica closed, Ford Fry was very candid and just said, look, we didn't do as good a job as we needed to. And by the way, Star Rover is like one of the hottest restaurants in town right now, right? Like you can't, you know, you gotta book that reservation several days in advance if you want to go for prime time. So, you know, they made the right decision to move on from it. And I think Michael Sandbrooks is making the right decision by kind of stepping into that neighborhood and going, here we are.
It's a family neighborhood. At the end of the day, Tex-Mex is family friendly. Slam dunk.
All right, let's move on to topic number two. The Los Angeles-based Wish You Were Here group is opening two new restaurants at Central Park Post Oak. One is called Elefante. It is an Italian restaurant. The other is Bar Bambino, which is a cocktail bar with like some shareable bites. Central Park Post Oak is like located on Post Oak Boulevard. It's a 17-acre property right there between Westheimer and San Felipe. It is under construction. We'll start to see these new restaurants open maybe at the end of this year, maybe early next year. But the previously announced tenants include Bucket Rider, a seafood restaurant from Arizona, The Henry, which recently opened in the Town and Country area, Sparrow Italia, an Italian steakhouse, and our beloved, our one plucky local, Handy's Dozo, the hand roll concept from Duckstosh Hospitality. Rafi, I know you get to travel a little bit. I don't suppose you've been out to LA or Scottsdale and had the experience of trying Elefante.
I have been to both. My wife's family is from Arizona, so we go to Phoenix quite often, and it's made my list of places to try there. I was in LA last year and we were driving up to Santa Barbara. It made my list of places to go while going through Santa Monica. You know, California, Italian is always going to be something popular, I think. Other than like scouring their menu and their Google photos, that's really all I know about it. Menu looks interesting. I think we need to evaluate, you know, how much Italian can Post Oak handle.
No, yes, I'm glad you brought that up because I was sort of thinking about this. Like I kind of looked at the menu and I'm like, oh, you know, there's a mochi crudo, there's meatballs, there's the obligatory spicy vodka pasta, there's bone-in veal milanese, there's, you know, there's all the usual kind of classic Italian fare. Now they do have pizza, which I think is important. But if you just think about like even within a couple of blocks of this location, you've got North Italia, which has been incredibly popular, just a nonstop juggernaut from the day it opened. And then, you know, a little farther down the street on the other side of the street, you've got El Braco from Dallas, which I like quite a bit. And then if you keep going down Post Oak, you get to Uptown Park and you get to Lombardi, which is its kind of CNBC and like very stylish Italian food. And then if you cross 610 and you go to River Oaks District, you've got Bari. And so, you know, it seems to me that that's a lot of Italian food, and to say nothing of Tavola, also on Post Oak from the same company that operates Le Jardinet. So they know a little bit about what they're doing. So all in, I mean, it just sounds like a lot of Italian food to me. I don't want to make any predictions about how Elefante will fit in or not fit in. I mean, obviously, this Los Angeles-based Wish You Were Here group knows all this. Like they clearly came here and drove around and saw, you know, looked at the TABC numbers and all that and made some decisions about how they could compete. But it does seem like a lot of Italian food to me.
I think that Houston had a lack of Italian options. And then we had a massive overcorrection. And I don't know if we had that many quality parts to that overcorrection. So maybe they can be that. At the end of the day, pizza and pasta are the most approachable foods on planet Earth. And
they're cheap to make.
And they're cheap to make. So they make for a profitable business. So they've clearly done the math to your point. I think one of the challenging things I'm noticing from these new developments is at what point are you open in the phase of the development? I've talked to the Handy's Duozo guys. You know, for example, they have their spot over there in Autry Park. They opened in Autry Park, and you kind of want to be open in the later end of these developments, or hopefully the landlord spends some money on marketing to get people in the door at the beginning, which we all know that doesn't happen.
Right. I mean, I think part of what happened with Auden, also in Autry Park, is that they were first. and people didn't quite know where it was and they weren't sure what the situation was. And, you know, it had some stumbles on the culinary side. It had some growing up to do, but it didn't really get the opportunity that it probably deserved. And Handy's Dozo is a more accessible, or Doko rather, is a more accessible concept because everybody knows what sushi is. It serves the tenants of both apartment buildings on that property very well. And they were later. So it was, you know, there were more units leased. There were more people who were familiar with the development. And obviously it's going pretty well for them. Like Elefante is coming into phase two. So all of these other restaurants will already be open by the time it opens. And people will be familiar with what Central Park Post Oak is. They'll have been to Buck and Rider. They'll have been to Sparrow Italia. And they'll be like, oh, you know, a new alternative to North and El Braco. Like, let's check that out. So I think they'll get a decent shot of it. I do think that's right. And I think, you know, I just think there's a certain magic about a Post Oak address. You know, like this is our like most touristy area with the Galleria right down the street. Restaurant spaces are at a premium between, say, Westheimer and 610 on Post Oak. And so it's not a surprise that these out-of-town operators, as they're kind of looking like where to go, you know, they see Fox Restaurants is there and they're like, okay, Flower Child at Uptown Park and North Italia on Post Oak at Boulevard Place, like, let's go. Like, if they're there, then that's where we're supposed to be too.
I think also this development will get the benefit of daytime, weekday lunch business from businessmen and women as well. I think that definitely probably played into it. And we'll see how it goes. Maybe we'll try when they open.
Yeah, a big happy hour, I'm sure, on that same logic. All right, let's move on to topic number three. I want to talk Top Chef with you. I apologize to the members of the audience if you do not watch Top Chef or you are tired of Top Chef talk because the finale aired a week ago, but we haven't had a chance to talk about it. And I love Top Chef. I've watched basically every episode of every season. Congrats to Rhoda Mogbatong on her victory. Oh, by the way, if this isn't obvious, spoilers for all of season 23 of Top Chef. Rhoda defeated Sherry Cardozo and Lawrence Louis. Rafi, I listened to The Watch, the Ringer podcast with, you know, Chris Ryan and Andy Greenberg, and they've been pretty critical of this season of Top Chef. They felt like it was a little bit claustrophobic. They felt like there wasn't, you know, in season 22, obviously for Houstonians especially, we were all rooting for Tristan, and Tristan basically dominated that season from start to finish. It was a very easy to watch season, especially for us because we knew Tristan and were rooting for him. This was more of an up and down season. There were fewer likable characters. There was the whole problem with the one chef who had a soldier injury and then was ultimately dismissed from the show because she developed Bell's palsy. Just a kind of a tragic run for her. Our only representative, Jossie Bindra from Houston, went out in the second episode in what was just like maybe the most classic series of like bad decisions a chef can make. And like cooking spicy food when you don't like spicy food, listening to your teammates who were trying to help you, maybe help you or undermine you, change the flavor of your dish. It all went off the rails and Jossie went out early. But I've rambled on long enough. I don't know. What did you think of this season?
I think you're right. I think at the end of the day, it's, by the way, I don't watch, even though I've been on one of these shows, I don't watch a lot of these reality TV cooking shows. This is the only one I habitually watch. And at the end of the day, reality TV requires drama. That's what you watch it for. I think this season lacked a little bit of drama. I think the producers tried to make part of the drama a married couple and brothers competing against each other. And I just don't think that was enough. I think we talked about this. You could definitely tell there were some budget cuts from the lack of the BMW sponsorship.
Right, right. They lost the BMW sponsorship. They're rolling around in these generic looking minivans. It's like such a step down. And then for the finale, for the first time in, I don't know, maybe since the COVID season and even going back longer than that, they didn't go somewhere else for the finale. The finale stayed in the Carolinas, which is like, if I were a Top Chef finalist, I would feel a little bit cheated out of an international trip, right? Or something, you know, like you're supposed to get rewarded for making the finals and they didn't really get that much.
You and I have talked about this. I actually disagree. I hate them randomly going to another destination. I think it's so out of place, but we talked about how, like, you know, Tristan got to use that as an opportunity to twist his final menu into this amazing, amazing experience that blew the judges' minds. I mean, I think, you know, do I think the right chef won? I think Rhoda did win. I think at the end of the day, when it comes to those final three people, it's about who cooks the best meal. And you can either make something really personal and really delicious. You can swing for the fences. But at the end of the day, you have to be consistent, swing for the fences, and cook a delicious meal. And I think she kind of did that, made the least amount of errors. I think Sherry gave her a good run, and the ice cream Sherry gave screwed her.
Yeah, I think if Sherry had landed the dessert, if the ice cream hadn't melted, I think Sherry could have won. Coming into the episode, I really felt like it was Lawrence's to lose.
Yes.
But after he overcooked the duck, he was done. You cannot mess up your main protein and win Top Chef. That's just not possible. But he had an incredible run. I would go to any, like, if he ever came to Houston and did a pop-up or collab, like, I would absolutely pay for that, because his food looked consistently delicious the entire season.
I think in that final meal, sometimes the lack of fine dining experience tends to hurt some of these guys that can cook delicious food all year long, but that, like, concise three-course meal, it's kind of hard to thread the needle. Jossie told me he's an amazing chef. Jossie had a crazy turnout for his dinner with all those guys coming to town. And yeah, he got screwed. I talked to him about it. And, you know, that's, at the end of the day, it's a game show. Jossie's won Top Chef. I think he was in Top Chef.
No, he won Chopped.
Well. Sorry, Chopped. I'm going to say Chopped. I think he was in Chopped champion as well. At the end of the day, this is a game show, and you have to play the game. And don't let it play you.
We should say Rhoda, the first Filipino Top Chef winner since, wait for it, Paul Key, the Top Chef winner we're not allowed to talk about from Austin with restaurants in Houston. We're not allowed to talk about that Paul won Top Chef, but, you know, a proud moment for all of our Filipino friends and neighbors. They got another one.
I would love to go to Hawaii and try our food. It looks really nice.
It does. You know, the only other thing, and I talked about this a little bit with Michael Fulmer a few weeks ago, but I didn't realize until I started watching some of these Food Network shows the extent to which Top Chef is now a feeding ground for shows like 24 and 24 or Tournament of Champions or any other sort of like competition style cooking show on the Food Network. It's like that's how they find people. And then these Top Chef competitors, because they've been challenged in so many different ways, because they get all of these other TV opportunities, then seem to do very well. Leanne Wong just won 24 and 24. She beat Alex Stupak in the final. And that's someone who goes back to, I think, the first or second season of Top Chef. Like, she's OG, you know, and she's done Tournament of Champions any number of times and came up short. It's an interesting feeder system or training ground or whatever. So I wouldn't be surprised to see whether it's Lawrence or Shirley or even Rhoda, like, show up on some of these other shows or maybe Padma Lakshmi's new show, America's Culinary Cup. Like, I think there's like an interesting dynamic where Top Chef has kind of set the standard and then turns out all these really talented chefs who are good at cooking on television.
Being friends with Henry and Evelyn and Dawn and Tristan and Jossie, I've had behind the scenes conversations that this is by far the hardest show in food TV. The way they challenge you, the mind game they play, the lack of being able to talk to your family, the not having a phone for 40 days, the isolation part of it. It's a challenge.
I suppose I should ask you before we wrap this up, would you do it? Would you go on Top Chef?
Man, I don't know if I have the chops. I think I would do it. It'd be a lot of time away from my family now that I have a son and a lot of time away from my business. I would like to say my business can handle me being away from that long. Sure, why not?
All right, casting agents, hit Rafi up. All right, I'm going to say that does it for the news of the week. We'll be right back with our restaurant of the week. Stick around. Rafi, for our restaurant of the week, I want to talk to you about Kirkwood. This is the luxurious new restaurant on I-10 at Kirkwood. It is owned by Mack Hike, Houston Oilers legend, car dealer extraordinaire. It is at a development that is owned by Mack with office buildings and a hotel. This is a very large restaurant. It's a very pretty restaurant. Jin Design Group kind of looked to Mack's personal history in Houston and also just sort of Houston history to design the space. It's got a, well, let's start there. I want to talk about the food, but let's talk about the experience. What were your first impressions kind of walking into Kirkwood and seeing this really elaborate design that Jin Design created?
Well, I'll tell you what, the experience did start from walking in. You know, someone held the door for me. I was politely greeted by a host stand. I had the hostess walk me to the table, which is a giant restaurant. So it's a long walk. She asked me how I was doing. And in my experience working at, you know, Papa's, this is the basics of hospitality. Beautiful restaurant, very well designed. I was shocked at how nice it was on the inside. I was not expecting that for a restaurant at the bottom of an office building, let alone a restaurant on the west side of town. I should say I grew up in the neighborhood literally behind this. My parents still live in the Kirkwood neighborhood at I-10. So for me, I was pretty floored just by walking in and seeing the place.
Yeah, there's a ton of different details. I mean, you walk in past the hostess stand, there's like a little lounge, and on all these shelves are these like kind of knickknacks or artifacts or mementos of Mack Hike's career. You keep going. The bar is beautifully lit. Custom bar stools. They're apparently in the shape of the sports seats from the Porsche 928 that Mack bought his wife in the 80s. I mean, you know, and then you keep going and there's this big open kitchen and there's these booths and then there's tables and there's different flooring surfaces. There's wood in some places and terracotta tiles in another. And then we were all the way back in what they call the sunny room, which has a two-sided fireplace, like a curved bar, a lot of light, and then like very beautiful art on the far wall, which is where we were sitting from another local artist. And there's just so many little details. And Emily Cotton wrote a whole article about the design of this restaurant. She interviewed Jin for Culture Map. And it's worth reading, I think, because you just, it's so comprehensive, all the little details. Like, much has been made of that like Astrodome-inspired ceiling. And what's crazy is like, it's one little moment right at the entrance. And if you don't look up, you will miss it. And that's Root Lab and it's gorgeous, but it's like, it's one tiny vignette in this huge space. And so I've heard various people speculating about how much money it cost to build this thing. It's a lot. It might even be like an eight-digit number to have built this place out, given the requirements of being in an office building and all the like the custom carts for the cocktails and to carve the Chateaubriand and all these other little touches that they've rolled out in this place. I mean, it's an impressive facility. And I should say, as we kind of move into the food, the neighborhood is discovered this. Like there, you know, it got a big PR push, a lot of media coverage, a lot of influencers have already been in, and the neighborhood's into it. I mean, we went on a Wednesday night, and 7 o'clock, that dining room was full, and it basically stayed that way for most of the time we were there.
Yeah, I think what this neighborhood needed was one, something on the higher end scale. I mean, since I've been living in this neighborhood my whole life, but the crowd was mixed. It was a lot of power dinner people. So I think that's what this restaurant will make its bones on, is all the oil and gas people in the area needed a place to go eat. So power lunches, power dinners. I think a lot of the area, a lot of ladies are going to do kind of their date nights with friends and all have girls night and grab a bunch of drinks and, I think this area lacked that. And then I think there's still going to be just the casual, you know, families and date nights there. So it was full.
I think that's well said. And I think, you know, to your point, until Kirkwood opened, if you wanted a nice meal in this area, you were probably going to City Center. More recently now, you've got Bar Blue Dorn and Latuli, but that's a little farther east. That's another 4 or 5 miles down the freeway. And if you live out at Highway 6 or even closer to Katy, you may not want to drive that extra distance. This is available to you now. And so I think it's going to draw a pretty good crowd just for its, you know, as long as the food is good. And, you know, let's be honest, the food was pretty good, I think. What were some of your favorites of what we ate?
I definitely enjoyed the food. We had a bunch of appetizers. We had the caviar service, the arancini balls. Forget my name. They didn't call arancini.
No, they call them cacio e pepe frittatini, but they're arancini.
They're really tasty. Good sauce, good crust on the outside.
The beef tartare was very, very good.
That was my standout, and which, I mean, there's a million different places in the world you can get this dish here in Houston. But I thought it stood out. It was flavorful, strong mustard flavor. Quality of the beef was great. And then we got a bunch of different entrees. We got the New York strip was perfectly cooked, perfectly seasoned. The short rib was tender and really tasty. The ravioli was, truffle ravioli was really good. Oozing out, fresh pasta, creamy sauce. I was really impressed. I think the chef there did a great job. And he came by the table and walked us through the menu. And I saw all those carts going around with the Chateaubriand. I kind of want to try that next time.
Yeah, I just, you know, for our purposes, I didn't think Chateaubriand made sense because I didn't, you know, we want to try multiple entrees, not one big one. And also, you know, filet is kind of whatever for me. But
I feel the same way.
But it is impressive looking visually. And when they roll it out on the cart and they're slicing the table side, you do kind of go, ooh, maybe I do kind of want that. Yes, Chef Stephen Chang worked for Relish for a while. He was at the Petroleum Club, and then he's now the culinary director for Kirkwood. He was very kind to come out on a busy night and banter with us for a few minutes. You know, I'm with you. I thought the New York strip was really nicely cooked. I thought that the truffle ravioli was definitely a standout. You kind of, you know, you worry it's going to be fake tasting or truffle oily, and it wasn't. It had a very nice, like, you know, where the truffle like enhanced the cheese without being perfumey or overwhelming. I thought the steak frites with the au poivre sauce was really nice. I thought the short rib was tender and nicely cooked. I mean, there's a lot to like, and then we had the pork chop, and in some ways, like,
that was great.
You know, I think that was maybe my favorite dish. Kind of somewhere on that spectrum, not as like intensely like porky and savory as the Basso pork chop, maybe a little sweeter, like more in the style of Perry's, but like definitely in the conversation with any of the notable pork chops in this town. It's nice to see them using that grill so well. You know, the only thing that I would say is that this menu really plays it safe. There's nothing on this, like the weirdest thing on this menu is the buffalo wings, which don't make any sense at all, basically, because there's nothing else handheld. There's nothing else like super saucy on this whole menu. And you know, you think, well, it's owned by a retired football player and they have this big bar with TVs, so maybe they're for the bar. But like, that was just they were tasty, but they were weird. Like, I don't understand their presence on the menu. Everything else kind of makes sense to me. It's just really right down the middle, like a Houston J. Alexander's kind of like crowd favorite, crowd pleasing dishes, but done well, but just very safe.
I think Chef Steven built a menu that is going to be successful for the area and for the restaurant. I always say you have to service the neighborhood that you're in. You know, you don't want to create some dishes that are going to try to bring people. You got to serve the people that are in your neighborhood. I think that's what he's doing. Chef Steven, at the end of the day, you got to execute this early on for people to even care. And I think that's what I'm going to give him some credit for. So I'm going to ding one thing. The agua chile appetizer was a little too acidic, but I'm Peruvian. I'm biased. So I give him a lot of credit. I'll tell you what, this neighborhood has been desperate for something like this. And I think going, you know, hitting home runs at the very beginning was a key to the success of a under an office building restaurant. Cause you don't have that much runway, you know?
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think the volume they're doing, I mean, he came by and he told us they, you know, they were going to do 400 covers over the course of lunch and dinner, which is quite a bit, you know, especially for a new restaurant, especially for a restaurant that's still like settling in and getting its feet wet. So, you know, that they're playing it safe right now. I mean, I think what you said is on point, right? This is how you kind of get a restaurant like this off the ground. Like when I start talking about what are the best new restaurants of the year, I'm going to go for something that's a little more ambitious, right? You know, the Green Room, certainly, where it's just like it's similar classic, but just there's like another level of like culinary ambition, right? That's what appeals to me, you know, as a writer and a podcaster and a snob, frankly. I want a little more, but I understand why they're doing what they're doing. And it makes sense from a business perspective. It's just, I'm not that personally excited about what's going on at Kirkwood, but if I lived in that neighborhood, I think I would be very excited just to have a nice place to get a steak or a burger or a piece of fish that doesn't involve like having to mess with city center. So I get it.
People do not like driving far to eat at restaurants. And I think they're going to benefit a lot from a neighborhood that doesn't have options like this. I think, you know, the Hillstone menu comparison, while valid at the end of the day, we'd all like to make the money Hillstone makes as restaurant operators. It works.
No, it works. And this is their first this is Matt Kike's first foray into fine dining. For the most part, they're franchise operators, right? They own a bunch of First Watches. They're bringing a new chicken concept to town. They've done some other stuff, but this is how you get your feet wet. You play it safe. You see how it goes. If Chef Steven and Matt Kike are still on the same page a couple of years from now, and they want to do something a little more ambitious, like, you know, they've certainly got the financial resources to do that, and we'll see. But for now, I think from my perspective, for the people that are listening to the show, if you live in the Memorial Energy Corridor, Katy area, Spring Branch, this is worth checking out. If you're coming from farther away, I mean, unless you just want to see the place because it is so beautiful, I think it's a tightly set for sell, I think.
Got to mention that Matt Kike is one of our great Lebanese entrepreneurs in Houston. So I know everyone says Matt Kike, but it's Hike.
Well, all right. So Houston Lebanese Entrepreneur Hall of Fame, right? You've obviously Matt Kike is up there. The Jamail family is up there.
Of course.
Seraphim.
Yeah.
You know, the family behind Phoenicia, right?
Yep.
So you're a native Houstonian and a person of Lebanese descent. Who's the greatest Lebanese Houstonian of all time?
Man, that's a tough one. I think in the Lebanese community, the Jamail family is probably the most well known. But yeah, I think it's, what's funny, I met Mac a few times. He used to come to an old restaurant I used to manage. And I did not know until my father brought it up one time. And I was like, oh, now I get it. You know, it's that generation of Lebanese, they assimilated really well. And I think he might also be the most famous Lebanese NFL player of all time. Because I don't know Robert Saleh. I don't even know if he played. I know he's a coach, but yeah.
All right. Well, that seems like a good place to wrap this up. Rafi, thank you very much.
Thank you. Had a great time, Eric, and look forward to coming back on another time.
That's it for today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Join me on Thursday when my guest will be Amber Ambrose.